Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. Pandemics, disasters, sustainability, and tourism. It demands your immediate attention, and some might say it begs the question, what is your call to action? Hello, everyone, and welcome to University Drive. Pandemics, Disasters, Sustainability, and Tourism is the title of a new scholarly publication based on research conducted by UB faculty Dr. Ian Bethel Bennett and Ms. Jessica Minnis, and also their colleague, Dr. Sophia Roll. On this episode of University Drive, our guests are Dr. Bethel Bennett and Ms. Minnis, here to talk about this research publication. Welcome and thank you both for joining us here on University Drive.
Thank you very much, Tamika, for having us on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, yes, a pleasure to have you here, I can tell you. And you've returned to us, Dr. Bethel Bennett, so we're very pleased with that. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background so that they can understand in terms of your experience and relevance for the discussion that we're having. We'll start with the lady, Ms. Minnis.
Yes, I am Jessica Minnis, and I am in the School of Social Sciences, where I teach sociology. And that is a part of the Faculty of Social and Educational Studies. And I've been teaching at the college for quite a number of years and thoroughly enjoy my experiences and sharing what I know with students, and to be able to let them come back and tell me that they still remember the class and they're applying what they're learning, what they have learned in the class. So that makes me feel good.
I'm very glad about that. And Dr. Bethel Bennett, I hear you're one of the popular faculty members on campus because of the rigor of your classes.
Definitely popular. My goodness, I could be so popular. I'm based in the School of English Studies. I tend to teach more English 300 and literature courses. The English 300 courses are designed for the rigor of upper level university courses. So the idea behind them across the academy is that I am teaching students to write in their disciplines. Unfortunately, students think that this is unreasonable a lot of the time, and that the expectations are too high because I expect them to put into practice what they learned in 119 and 120. And I know this because the students offer feedback that they think professors don't read. So I moved to the to the College of the Bahamas in 2010 from the University of Puerto Rico. Prior to that, I was at the Organization of American States in the Trade Department. And then after that, I was with the Inter-American Commission of Women, where I've done two or three stints. I do a lot of work in gender equality and equity and looking at development through a gendered lens. When I say development, I don't just mean the economics of development. I mean all aspects of development. When I was doing a trade degree in trade policy, I did a lot on tourism and gender, or gender and tourism. So I hope some of this makes sense.
Well, as a COB/UB grad, I'm here to tell you that high pressure demands lead to high quality graduates. So, you know, don't worry about that bit. So I'm very intrigued by the title of your scholarly publication. It's very specific. Pandemics, Disasters, Sustainability, and Tourism. Tell me, Dr. Bethel Bennett, how did the trio decide to do research in this area and bring out a publication? What led to that?
We had just completed the manuscript on tourism in the Bahamas, so looking at sustainability in tourism in the Bahamas. And I was doing a lot of work on natural disasters or hurricanes, really, because we tend to just focus on hurricanes until earthquakes really take over. And I was doing a lot of research on what was happening in that aspect in Haiti and in Puerto Rico. And we tend to ignore the fact that anytime there is a contagion, for example, the Asian market collapse in, I think it was 1997, 98, that there are these knock-on effects. And we wanted to look at how tourism responded to not just Hurricane Dorian, but also the pandemic, and the fact that the pandemic showed us that we need to do something different. Otherwise, we sink further into poverty. When I was doing my master's in trade policy, I did a study in a regression analysis in the ways that tourism causes economic standstills when it hits external or exogenous moments of crisis. So 2001, and there was another one after the savings and loan crisis, and then there was another one in 2007-8. We don't see these, but you will note that they happen because of the impact in the numbers, especially after September 11th, 2001. So I hope I've answered that part of the question. And just to get a better idea of how interrelated the Caribbean is in terms of having similar experiences, while each national economy is structured differently, the Bahamas fits into a post-colony reality where the economy doesn't really belong to the country. I hope that makes sense.
It does. It does. And what I also find intriguing, Ms. Minnis, if you can speak to this, is that you're not only focusing on the disasters or the calamities, but you're also focusing on resilience in Caribbean small island developing states. Why?
Because of the different kinds of crises that we've had to go through. And somehow we've been able to pull out of them. It might take a while, and some have and some haven't. And then we want to know what kinds of mechanisms were put in place to mitigate against such disasters coming in. We have enough information to share with each other. What were the best practices that we might be able to use and other countries might be able to use and share? Because when we look at it, there is a big interconnection, as Ian said, with sustainability. We just can't sit down and say, oh, it happened, and not come up with solutions. We've been able to find ways to bounce back. I think especially for the Bahamas, when we look at the hurricanes, because we're impacted by that. And although tourism is our number one, one of our important industries, we've been able to market ourselves and repackage ourselves so that at least the invisible market and those that are removed from but still are part of the economy are able to continue. And we have to see how they are also connected globally. So it isn't just happening to us, it is happening elsewhere. We also have to recognize that some of this is global, and how do we cope? It is not going to change. Sea level rise, we might not in a great way contribute to it, but we are going to be impacted by it. Hurricanes, Dorian was a very good example. It sat over us for, 2 days? That's unusual, I mean, except for the one that happened in Long Island too, or Ragged Island. They're becoming a little bit more. And when you talk to the environmentalists, people don't believe there's a climate change, but even if you don't, when we get to see what is happening, we can't argue it's there, and we have to be able to cope. We have to be able to find solutions and recommendations so that people's lives can continue, because that's the most important thing for governments, that they have to make sure that their citizens are taken care of and that they can meet their needs. And if we get to understand and put some things in place even prior to, then the impact would not be as great. Not saying that is not going to happen, but at least we can lessen it, soften it a little bit. And we then plan and we know what to do, as opposed to waiting for something to happen. But at least we'll have some idea of how we can sustain ourselves. And so this book brought us together so that we can share with other, to hear what other people in the Caribbean or academics in the Caribbean are saying about how they coped. Some of the ways that they did. And also we could say, well, we never thought about that. Maybe we should try this, or we could borrow from, or we need to rethink how we've been doing things in the past. And now we can change some things around, get some mindset, get people to see the connections, because it's not going to go away. And as small islands, we are very dependent, as Ian brought out. We are dependent economically on bigger nations. And to some extent, sometimes they contribute to some of the issues that small island states are facing now. But we can't sit back and wait for them to do it. We also have to be able to move forward ourselves.
So I'm curious, particularly as I continue to look at the title of this, is there a difference between small island developing states and archipelagic nations? Because, you know, I'm sure that small island developing states share some vulnerabilities, but there are also other things to bear in mind if you're an archipelagic nation like the Bahamas, right?
Yes, very much so.
Well, okay, so we have a small island developing state like Barbados, which is one landmass. And so whatever is developed in Barbados serves the entire country, so to speak. In the Bahamas, we have to continually replicate structures. And this is a challenge because since the 1960s, we have been encouraging people to move to the capital. So we've been depopulating the out islands or outer islands and overpopulating the capital. So these are two very different things, because you have to think about the sustainability and the connectivity. And that was something that we were focusing on with Ragged Island, the project that I worked on or work on Ragged Island, because looking at the ways family islands are able to link with the capital and how easy it is to move goods and services across the space. Because one of the big challenges is the connectivity. And especially when you're looking at disaster policy or hurricane policy, there is really no robust policy to address the nature of the Bahamas that will provide for the people who live on the smaller and less populated islands.
The small islands, and of course, all the islands are in different stages of development in terms of how far on their economies are and how robust their economies are. And yeah, I think one of our greatest challenges, as Ian pointed out, is the fact that we are an archipelagic nation. And yeah, we have to, you know, the question always comes, but why don't we put a hospital there? Why don't we put another school there? Why don't we do these? But, you know, and most of our islands, the distribution of the population is so different. And then all of our goods and services are located in New Providence, because most of our infrastructure is here. And so that is something that we have to, you know, what the government has to face is making those determinations. How to develop the islands, and should you for an island that might only have 600, but it's a long island, it's a big island, what kinds of facilities do you put in there? And to meet their needs without, disenfranchising them in any way.
And one of the things I think we can add is that sustainability is not just about tourism. Sustainability is about the way the entire country is developed. So looking at the way infrastructure is provided, the way it's delivered, the education, for example, how the entire population has access to education. And that was something that we understood the impact of coming out of the pandemic and coming out of Hurricane Dorian. So understanding that in order to have successful business on Bimini, you have to have banking, you have to have infrastructure that allows the locals to participate actively in the economy and not just have hotels with cash points for tourists.
So what are some other key findings that you were able to discover in investigating the subject matter, such that key stakeholders, for instance, in the Bahamas, can synthesize the information in order to make us more resilient?
It's interesting because the point that, don't forget, this is an edited book. We had other Caribbean authors contribute, and so their topics were different, but we recognize that we don't have the year-round weather that attracted, we have to, it's different. The things are different now. And so we have to find different ways. So some of the islands would do things a little bit differently from what we have. Our geography, especially being close to the United States, makes us a little bit more viable because tourists, when any natural disaster might impact them, and if they need to travel outside, the Bahamas is close. And so this is one of the things by geography we are very fortunate for, because then when they take their breaks, they don't, if they don't have the money to go very far, then the Bahamas is the ideal. And then of course the climate makes it easier too. And then of course it's the exchange of currency that also makes it easier too. Compared to the other islands that are further down in the south, so they're relying more on, and the history of it is that they rely a lot on agriculture. They also have some other natural minerals that they're able to capitalize on. And so this is what makes us different. And so we recognize their vulnerability. We know that they also say that they have to plan for things. And the other thing that makes it so, we have to think about the psychological well-being of our people, because we tend to just focusing on rebuilding the infrastructure, but we never, some things, some other things we have to look at too is the population and how best, what is their psychological, how their coping mechanisms. And making sure that they are that their needs are met, and that they can move forward. So those are some of the issues that we found that were common through some of the islands that we got our articles, our chapters from, the people who contributed to them.
One of the authors titles his chapter Normal No More, because people continue to talk about going back. We will return to normalcy. There is no normality that will return. We have to move forward. And the forward movement is where we will learn the new lessons, because the economy has completely changed. It is no longer the same economy we had prior to the pandemic. And if until we understand that, we will be spinning top in mud.
Yeah, And not only, and this is not just for one stakeholder only. This is across the board, both public and private. And so there is the coordination efforts, at least sharing of information so that people get to know, and without having duplication of efforts, that if we can have a disaster, and this is something that some of the psychologists in the Caribbean are working on right now, some of the disaster preparedness, what are some of the things that we can tell people beforehand, or just let them know that these are some alternatives that you can do in order to one, cope with it, cope with the loss, because when you lose your house, where are you going to go? And that's one of the key concerns that people have. If they've lost everything, how do they get back up on their feet? So we have to be able to offer some solutions or some recommendations so that gradually individuals would be able to piece their lives back together. And this is not just for government alone. This is for everybody coming together, all the different agencies that are there trying to help individuals cope in the short term. And then, of course, moving forward. So these are some of the recommendations and feedback that we're getting from the different authors in the different islands that contributed to the book.
Lessons for us all.
Yes.
I'm glad you clarified that this book actually is a compilation of work from researchers and academics throughout the region. How did you select submissions, or how did you invite submissions? How did you decide which ones to feature?
We sent out a call. A call for chapters. We said what the purpose of and what we wanted to look at, and we gave them different topics that they might consider. And if they came up with something that was really pressing for them and was of importance in their islands, then they submitted their abstract. And if it fit in with the themes that we wanted, and if it really was of high quality and making some good recommendations, then they were accepted. And then they were able to complete the chapter and submit the chapter. And of course, the book had different subheadings. And so each of those chapters that dealt with that particular subheading was included.
And the book has to go through different stages of peer review. So there, it's not just that people submit and then they're accepted. Even at each step, you have a series of peer reviewers that go through the book and see, or the abstracts, and see whether this is something that they want to invest in. And then again, halfway through, and then at the end. So one of the other ways was through relationships that we had developed at conferences, for example. So if we go to a conference where they're on sustainability and there are people working on this area, we would know them and ask them to submit if they were interested. So that's another way that we were able to pull together so many diverse people. And again, the fact that the entire Caribbean is going through this at the same time, as well as the Pacific, is interesting, because the Pacific gives us lessons that we have not necessarily thought about yet. So I did a sustainable development and tourism course based in the Pacific that was very different from anything that we had done here. But it had a lot of Caribbean people and Latin Americans in the course. So again, you develop relationships that way.
Yeah, and it's good to be aware of different situations and circumstances, right? Because they can represent, or they can generate for us lessons that we might not have ever thought of, different perspectives and different approaches that might be applicable and adapted for whatever context we so choose, right?
That is correct. Yes, and that's the beauty of it, the fact that we find out that we are not alone, and that there are other other islands who are going through basically something similar. And yes, they can share how they were able to navigate through it. And yes, so we don't have all the answers, but if we start talking to others, then we get to see. And not only that, then it gives you your creative juices start. But I never thought about that. Maybe we can do it this way. This will work here. And so that's the nicest thing about this is the fact that in talking with, in asking people, you get to see that there are things that we can share. And some things that are applicable that we might not have thought about that we can adapt or borrow.
All right. Well, thanks for that clarity and context. This is a good place for us to take our first break. You're listening to University Drive. More after this.
Chapter One Bookstore is your back-to-school headquarters. We are proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center throughout the semester for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael Eldon Complex. Call us at 397-2650 or email us at chapter1@uv.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. See you soon.
My name is Nicolette Bethel, and I'm a 2022 Wilson Award grant recipient. It's called Spatial Justice in the Postcolonial Bahamas. That's a working title. I'm not sure what the final title is going to be. So this is something that has been interesting me for a long time. How we make sense out of, or don't make sense out of, the land we live in, the space we occupy, and how we continue to oppress ourselves through our organization of space and geography. Well, okay, so it's important for a couple of reasons. One, it's invisible. It's almost totally invisible, and we don't realize when we're replicating it. Two, because we're an archipelago and we're the only archipelago of this size and magnitude in the Atlantic. Three, because our archipelago is really big, and the Bahamas is actually the biggest country in the Caribbean, but we never think of it like that because we're always thinking about islands. But when you put all the islands together, spread across all the water, we're the biggest country in the Caribbean. We're big. Hopefully, what I have to say will uncover new ideas, possibly break new ground. Spatial justice isn't an entirely new thing, but there's only a couple of us working in this arena in this country right now. So I would hope that it shifts a conversation and puts UB at the center of that conversation.
For more on the Wilson Awards and the Wilson Grants to fuel Bahamian research, contact grants@ub.edu.bs.
Welcome back to University Drive. We're talking with researchers Dr. Ian Bethel Bennett and Ms. Jessica Minnis, who have edited a scholarly publication that focuses on pandemics, disasters, sustainability, and tourism. And we're having a very compelling discussion about that. I am curious, though, sustainability and resilience. Are we talking about the same thing? Do they mean the same thing in this context?
Well, actually, sustainability is, it can allow us to become resilient. So sustainability is about putting in place mechanisms and policies and practices or best practices that allow us to live in a sustainable way. So that is not destroying all the mangroves, because once we destroy all the mangroves, there will not be any storm break or wave break that protects the island. And the fish stocks will be depleted because the fish use the mangroves. So understanding that there are sustainable policies, and this allows us to be more resilient because forward-looking policies that don't just sit in the now, they have to look forward to what is going to come. There's a paper that was published on Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and it was called Bouncing Forward. This has happened. Now, how do we go? And if you look at Puerto Rico's recovery from Hurricane Maria, we understand that there are a number of lessons that have to be learned from that experience. And one of them is that people have to understand where they can build and where they can't build. So we can't build in marshes. We can't build in low-lying lands. But we also have to understand that even though we have building codes, those building codes cannot be the same thing between Andros and New Providence, because these are different realities. And I think we have maybe two or three building inspectors. They can't get around to all the sites to inspect all the jobs. So we have challenges that are not addressed in a sustainable way and that lead to us not being resilient. I hope that makes it somewhat clearer.
Well, I agree with what Ian is saying. Sustainability is the fact that we have to be we can't think short term. It's good. We do that. Once it's over, we cannot. I'm not saying that you should always be in a heightened state of alert. But the fact is that we have to, if in order for you to maintain the quality of life that you would like to have, we have to be able to preserve. And we can't think short term. We have to think long term. And this is what, and I guess the three good examples for us in this country is grouper, conch, and the lobster. And if we don't understand, and I'm glad we have the different systems in place whereby, you know, open and close seasons, because then your children will be able to have some in the future. Because if we deplete, because we think the ocean and everything else is infinite, but it isn't. And not only, yes, our population is small, but we are not the only ones who are benefiting from what we have. So we have to preserve it. We can't think just short term, and we have to find alternatives. Not saying that you're not going to have it, but we just have to know that I would like to have this for another 50 years. I would like my grandchild or my great grandchild to be able to understand or to taste conch and to appreciate it. And it's the same thing with anything we do with the fruits and the vegetables that we have. We have to think long term. And so that's where the sustainability comes from. And if you destroy it, then what are you going to have? And for yourselves as well, so that is, and the resilience is, how do we bounce back? So you might be knocked down, but you're not going to stay down. And so our islands, so we get to see that, yeah, the pandemic knocked us, but we were able to still bounce back, and we found creative ways in which to do that. And so sometimes these pandemics and natural disasters, if we look at it another way, they just give us a little nudge to remind us, stop being complacent, and that we also have to also prepare some things and think about some things differently so that when it does come, we're not scrambling.
You know, whenever we talk about research and new knowledge, I always ask the question about how do we tie the knot between the information generated and impact on policy and outcomes so that it can be put into action. And this is particularly timely and relevant given that we recently observed the International Day for Disaster Risk Reduction. And there's said to be this heightened focus right now on increasing the capacity for the Bahamas to prepare and manage and execute disaster risk reduction. So how do we tie that knot between research information and impact on policy and outcomes and procedures?
One of the things that we really have to do is actually make policy real. There has policy can't just be something that we think works for New Providence or for Nassau. It has to be holistic across the board. How do we get food from here to there? What is the policy that addresses the food scarcity on some of the out islands? The policies that we seem to have are too reactionary. They don't show long-term sustainability, nor do they allow resilience to come about. And in order for that, like you say, you have to join up the research and the reality. So one way of dealing with post-disaster violence is that you, as Jessica was saying, you mitigate against the psychosocial and the socio-psycho impact of the disaster by having service within the communities. So you have to have decompression. We have ignored that aspect of the post-disaster or the post-natural event recovery.
And I think the other, and I think it's coming because we were at that point where these crises were coming kind of frequent. And we are now realizing, because of the research, because of the events that have unfolded, then we are coming to recognize that. And so communities, it's good. We need to build that community relationship where you train individuals in the communities to be able to address their issues. And so once we can at least give some people, some training in order to do that, then it cuts down the amount of resources that we might have to bring from outside, because you're getting people within the community themselves to be able to make decisions and to be able to help each other, because they're basically going through the same, but they are providing the support. And if they don't know, then they can tell them, well, this is where we need to go to get that information. So the community also and NGOs are very key in getting things done very quickly. And what really comes to mind for me was when Dorian hit Freeport, and I'm sure it happened here, but when you get to see a community coming together, when the guys in their jet skis and the guy in their tractor, dump truck, tractor, whatever they call that, to go out and rescue people. You know, we didn't wait. They didn't wait. They put their lives on the line for that. But those little things saved some people's lives. They were able to take them to higher ground. Those are some of the things we need to encourage, so that if the government can't get there right away, but they know that I can ask this group of individuals to mobilize. And you can tell them that this is where we need to go, or you can drop the people off. Then I think it will, in terms of policy and being able to help us get out of the crisis a little bit earlier and to be able to move forward in terms of resilience. Those are some, and it's just little things sometimes that are needed, not something sophisticated, but those little gestures certainly helps with recovery. It helps people psychologically to know that, yeah, then my neighbor is there. I can use this to get things done. And you don't have to be, if you train them efficiently and sufficiently, then it reduces. It's not going to put a stop to it, but it certainly helps. Tremendously when people... Go ahead, Ian.
One of the other things that, really needs to be built on is response to the event. After the event, we cannot think that people have just, they're just going to bounce forward. They're not going to bounce back. They have to bounce forward. And when we, people just want somebody to listen to them, to hear them, and they can pick up and move on. So it's not just about, oh, providing professional, as Jessica's saying, providing professional care. It's about allowing people to speak, not silencing those people with official discourse that basically takes the air out of the room and you leave people without any kind of expression. The community has to be able to articulate its loss. It has to be able to mourn its loss, and it has to be able to mourn with the ability to heal. These are huge parts of recovery, and that is resilience. So I hope I make sense there. When we don't recover, the violence and the anger fester and grow. And this is one of the challenges that we are seeing. It's not just about the Bahamas having a serious problem with young men being killed. And we have to be very clear that it is young Black men who are being killed, and they tend to come from a particular class group that is disadvantaged and disaffected. It is because there is no listening, no hearing, no healing, and no access. So there are a number of things that happen, especially after Dorian, and especially after the pandemic.
I'm glad you said what you said, Dr. Bethel Bennett, because I never really looked at it like that. We're talking about change behavior then, and action, and that is collective and all encompassing. I never really thought about deeply about the fact that when you have a disaster or a calamity, that a community should be able to articulate its loss, like you said, mourn and heal before we could even think about rebounding. That makes sense to me. It really does. So in the publication, what are some of the specific disasters that are being examined and where?
So we've had some, you know, after the COVID-19 crisis, we've had two out of Jamaica, and it was at one of the topics was adaptation amidst unprecedented change, the impact of COVID-19 on the accommodation worker in Jamaica. And, you know, they, the things that they went through, how did they cope in their jobs and what they're expected to do, and loss of jobs, and how do they support themselves out of work? Because, you know, the tourism industry was hit hard. So that's a cycle, you know, you're going to work, you had a permanent job or you had a steady job, and then all of a sudden you don't know where your next income is coming from or your next meal is coming from. And so, you know, it was, how do they cope? You know, do they ask for members, and they had to borrow money from individuals? And it was just that being locked up played a part on the individual. So this was some of the things. And then we looked at the community-based tourism in Jamaica, because you're looking at, you have the big hotels and everything like this, but, and then when the tourists come, you know, they looking at their community as a different way, and so they want to be able to control, and they want to be able to say, well, come and see me where I live, and what the nicest things about my environment. And so, and then of course, the, as Ian mentioned before, dispossession. Disasters bring dispossession, you know, earthquakes and floodings and volcano eruptions down in the Caribbean. We don't have that, but they've gone through that, you know. And so where do they go? And so you've been living in an area for so long, and then all of a sudden an earthquake comes, you have to move. Where do you move? And that's something, you know, psychologically people have to deal with, because you can't go back to that area for a while. That's a disaster area. You're looking at volcanoes, and that, you know, that impacts a person psychologically. Your land is not there. Your house is not there. All that you knew has been wiped out. And so where do you start? And so these are some of the topics that our authors addressed, and some of the ways that people were able to cope with that. But the whole thing about accumulation and dispossession, and the ways that people went about trying to deal with and cope with, and having it possibly to start all over again and to relocate because the familiar that you have is no longer there.
One of the areas that the book didn't cover but has been documented repeatedly is the volcano in Montserrat and the impact of that on the people from Montserrat, who are British but were discouraged from moving to Britain. So much like many of the Anglophone Caribbean people, home or their political economic home is Britain, because Britain has dominated this geopolitical space for a long time. What people forget is that in the wake of direct colonialism, you have residual colonialism. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the responsibility is not borne often by the colonial or the former colonial power. In many cases, that colonial power remains the colonial power. And we get into the whole way that the Montserratians have to abandon their island or move to the other half. But again, like Jessica is saying, where do they go? How do they rebuild? They have to rebuild completely in a different place. They can't go back to where they were because there is no back there anymore. So they have to move to Britain. Eventually, Britain opted to allow them entry. Then you have the Windrush generation and the impact that the neoliberal policies in Britain are having on them. And then after Dorian, Maria, Irma in the Caribbean, we see the accumulation of land that was damaged in the storm by large international interests or conglomerates, and the dispossession of small local communities, and the fact that their lives are completely wiped out by the acquisition of land through emergency mechanisms.
Yeah. And the other thing that what really surprised me is the fact that real estate becomes very popular after a disaster. And this is, and I thought, wow, that investors from outside are then calling to find out the price of the property. Can they buy this piece of land? And, you know, people are going through and you know, and the thing is, they figured that, you know, they could buy this for a little next to nothing. People would be happy to sell their property because, especially if they live near the water, because then they can redevelop that. And so you have this new piece coming in where people now, starting from outside, they see the opportunities for redevelopment and development, and at the expense of individuals who have just gone through a crisis. So that's also a part of this dispossession, and it's kind of people wanting to buy because they know that people might be in need of finances, but they recognize the value of the properties, and so therefore they might be willing to sell. So real estate booms too in after a crisis, and usually it's for some form of tourist development.
You both have been sharing so much with us that's food for thought and gives us cause to pause and reflect. Our time is winding down. It is amazing how quickly time flies. So as we wrap up and wind down now, what's next in terms of the scholarly publication that you've produced? Because this is a body of work. So what's next as we invite you both to give us your wrap up comments?
Well, I hope that this book will start the discussion, reignite, continue what we already know, what you hear about, and to know that there are other islands like us who are going through the same. And, our leaders go to United Nations and other on the environment, and we are talking about the same. So we need to continue the discussion. We need to make people aware, and not to say that we are alarmist or anything, but we also need to see the connection because we now live in a globalized environment. So what happens elsewhere impacts us too. Just think about, the war in the Ukraine. Yes, they're thousands of miles away, but subtly, we start talking about grain and food shortages and prices going up. So we have to now widen the discussion, be aware, be more in tuned to things that are happening around. And so I'm hoping that the publication that we have spurs those conversations and also encourage us to put some things in place. And I'm glad to see the government, having agriculture, having, these little backyard farmer kits that people can have and start, and just encourage us to. And it's nice to be able to say, I grew that tomato, I grew that that lettuce. And it helps with your food bill as well, eventually. So, yeah, and to know that small islands are different, archipelagos are different from one landmass. And America has been around for a very long time. Europe has been around for a very long time, so that they already have their resources and the monies. People say, yes, built on us. But we have to be able to also not wait and expand our opportunities for ourselves, and especially for the young people too, because we have to leave something for them, and we have to give them the tools in which to carry us forward.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bethel Bennett.
I think one of the big takeaways, or the focus that we need to have more of, is looking at the way globalization is really not necessarily constructive for small island developing states, because it creates such rampant contagion. In the Asian economic meltdown in the late 90s, they used the term Asian contagion. It wasn't actually an Asian contagion. It was a contagion that globalized mechanisms had allowed to develop. The same thing with the pandemic. It's not about this particular person doing it. It's about the way globalization has unevenly developed the world and allows a particular facility of movement within a particular group, and it disallows other mobility. So we're talking about immobility of small island developing states and their residents, whereas the hypermobility of first world or developed nations and the global capital that they inject around the place, and so negatively impact what is already seen as uneven development. And my artistic work looks at that in the way that it causes cultural erasure. So I think that's kind of where we need to start looking and creating policies that respond to that.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, there is room for so much more discussion and examination and scientific research on these matters. I want to thank you both for joining us here on University Drive. Thank you to our listeners for sticking with us for this episode. I also want to remind everyone to stay connected with University of the Bahamas by visiting www.ub.edu.bs, following us across all of our social media channels, like, follow, subscribe to stay connected with us. I'm your host, Tamika Lundy. This has been University Drive.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations and the Communications and Creative Arts Academic Unit at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.